This podcast episode is sponsored by Statera. Statera is a web-based application that helps youth athletes and their stakeholders estimate training load, track maturation status, monitor readiness, and manage injury. Put together by coaches working with busy youth athletes, Statera helps keep things simple and brings together the most important training information in one place to ensure that effective athlete-centered decisions can be made. No more complicated Excel tutorials and spreadsheets. Just upload your athlete's data and their training schedule and start to take control of their training commitments and workload. Make more informed decisions and protect your athlete's well-being, supporting their performance. Statera takes your data very seriously. GDPR compliant and registered with the ICO, choose from a range of maturation indices and validated measures, or customize your own. Statera can record any training variable, and all your data is fully exportable. To reach out today and get a free walkthrough, head over to www.statera.uk. That's STATERA.UK. Are you a parent or coach of an athlete aged 13 to 18? Are they receiving structured athletic development coaching or just training unsupervised, copy and pasting something from Instagram or bodybuilding.com, or training with a coach who isn't even qualified or experienced with youth athletes? Do you want to help your athlete improve their movement, nutrition, and mindset? Do you want to find a coach who specializes in youth athletes, has the highest level of qualifications, has over a decade of coaching experience, and a proven track record of developing athletes for regional, national, and professional levels in multiple sports? Well, listen up, because this is for you. I've recently created two ways that young athletes can now work with me. Firstly, in person within our Athlete Academy after-school sessions in Edinburgh, and secondly, via the Athlete Academy Online, our online training platform for young athletes without physical access to structured athletic development support. To find out more, head to our website, www.athleticevolution.co.uk, to inquire and find out more about the Athlete Academy, helping young athletes to improve movement, nutrition, and mindset to dominate in sport and in life. Welcome to the Athletic Evolution podcast. Today, I'm speaking with Tom Farrow. Tom is a physical performance specialist and the founder and co-director of Arete Performance. He was the head of physical performance for England and Team GB7's men's team until August, when the program was unfortunately cut due to losing funding during the coronavirus. Tom was also a contact skills specialist with the men's sevens program and has worked in this capacity with the 2016 Team GB women's sevens team, Tokyo Toshiba Brave, Fulham Football Club's academy, and Richmond Rugby Club. He has previously worked as a strength and conditioning coach with the English Institute of Sport, GB Canoe, and Speedworks. Until September 2014, Tom was a senior strength and conditioning coach with Wasps Rugby and co-led their First 15 program. After starting his own business, Tom also spent time working with the Wasps Academy program as both a strength and conditioning coach and a contact skills specialist. So, welcome to the podcast, Tom. It's great to have you today. Thanks for your time.
Thanks very much for having me, mate.
So for those who haven't come across you and Arete Performance, give us a bit of a background. What was your kind of own journey as an athlete growing up? What kind of sports did you play and how did that evolve into coaching?
So I was always very interested in lots of sports. I suppose I sort of never really excelled in any one thing, but played loads of different sports. So like rugby was a main one. Boxing was a main one through sort of later teenage years and before that and throughout, little bits of football, swimming, things like that. So exposure to a load of different stuff. Later on, found wrestling, but I was already sort of on my journey when I found wrestling, and that's sort of been sort of focus of a sport through my 20s. And I was always very interested in training myself, and I think I was into S&C before I knew what S&C was, in a sense that I was interested in training myself to be better at the sports I was playing, and I trained for that purpose. So I was very influenced by like Bruce Lee, so I'd read all his books about training, follow his training programs and things like that, and Arnold Schwarzenegger's Encyclopedia of Bodybuilding, you know, all that, these little books and
classics,
the classics. And then I'd write training programs for myself. Eventually I'd write training programs for my friends. So it was always a big part of what I was interested in. And then I sort of, I tried to go to sixth form. I didn't really want to go to sixth form, but I didn't know what I wanted to do. But I dropped out basically middle of the year, ended up working in the city in London as a quantity surveyor. So I remember feeling quite grown up at the time, but I was 17, and now working with like 17, 18 year olds, realizing how young I was in a way. And I realized within a couple of days of doing that, what a big mistake I'd made. I never wanted to work in an office. I'd basically gone there just because I didn't know what else to do. And then I did that for a year. And then I dropped out of that, sort of a bit lost, not knowing what to do, did every other job you can think of. And I've around probably 18, 19, come across S&C as a concept, as a discipline, as a potential for a job. And I thought that was pretty cool. So I started then working back towards that, which meant I had to go to like a night school for a little bit, then a foundation degree and a college course. So I did a few things to get back to university, basically. And then once got to university, I actually went to Loughborough to do physics, a foundation degree in physics, which was forced because they wouldn't let me on a sports science degree without, they said I could do sports science and physics, but I had to do a foundation degree in physics. And obviously Loughborough was meant to be the place to be. So I did that. But then for me, it wasn't right as a place. It wasn't right as a course. You know, it was just 300 people on the sports science course. Wasn't really given the idea of it, wasn't what I wanted anyway. So I ended up at St. Mary's and sort of ended up on a strength and conditioning science degree. And then from there was a lot more focus really, and a lot more understanding, I suppose, clarity in what I wanted to do. And just progressed from there through my career really.
And you've obviously, you know, reading through your bio and knowing what you do, you've obviously touched points in a lot of different arenas in terms of physical performance. So, you know, like you're saying, obviously rugby and Wasps and Seven and Tokyo Toshiba, but equally football in terms of Fulham, you know, water sports in terms of GB Canoe. So you had fingers in a few different pies doing different things at different times.
Yeah, I've been really lucky to just experience so many different environments, and some for long periods of time, like in the Sevens I've been with for over 5 years, Wasps I was there for over 3 years, but then other places like Tokyo Toshiba, I was just doing some consulting on contact skills for I think just over a week. But you know, you get to immerse yourself in this environment and it's so different, and then you learn from that. I feel we can get this into this a little bit in terms of the philosophy of coaching, but for me the best athletes are those who best solve the problems presented to them in their sport. I think it's the same thing as coaches, and then you've got this the specific arena of coaching with the sport you're working with at any one time, but there's a general skill of coaching. So I feel to develop that, a breadth of experience is really important, and I've been lucky to fall into some opportunities that have provided that, and I've also consciously aimed for that as well. I've been very aware that I've got an interest in lots of different things as well. I'm very interested in sport as a whole, almost like mastery as a whole, not just one sport. So I've always sort of seek to learn from as many different places as I could. And that's probably why when the opportunities came along, I've always said yes to them. And then at times making myself far too busy and far too stressed than I needed to, but it was always great learning. It's great learning opportunities.
No, that's awesome. I completely agree in terms of, you know, that idea of a breadth and having that problem solving ability is something I speak to my players a lot about, not just technically, but tactically, physically, nutritionally. Like, you know, if you can't solve your own problems, there comes a point where I can't help you on the pitch anymore. And you need to have that wherewithal to be able to analyze what's happening in front of you and figure it out. Absolutely. So what's your underlying driver for this? So you obviously kind of mentioned learning and a bit of a curiosity of different experiences. Have you ever thought about what's kind of that real big motivator for you?
Yeah, I think about it a lot, and I don't think it's something that I'm 100% clear on and something I'm still exploring in a way, but it's definitely centers around this idea of like mastery, potential, and I feel like it's to do with just making the most of this time we have, the short time we have on this earth. You know, like we're here to make the most of it, and I think you know, exceeding in competitive environments isn't the only way to make the most of it, but it's an exciting journey within what can be a bigger life. And so it's something I've always enjoyed, competition myself, never focused on it early enough, but also didn't have like the technical tactical abilities young enough to make moves in that in a sense, and maybe probably not more than anything, not the psychological discipline at a young age to be able to do it. I'm always so impressed with the the psychological maturity of so many of the young athletes I work with, because I didn't have that until I was much older, and maybe still haven't. So it's around this idea, and a retail as a concept is about living up to your full potential. So it's an idea I've connected with, and I think it was something that I connected with from reading about Bruce Lee and his approach to things, which is very centered around mastery. And I mean, Bruce Lee has been this point, you know, like, it's not something that I've like, I'm obsessed over in any way, but I read a biography of his when I was about 13 or 14, and then I went back and read that biography a couple of years ago, and I realized how much had almost grown just out of that influence, in the sense of my interest in training probably was sparked by that, but also my interest in philosophy. He talks about a philosopher called Krishnamurti, who I read when I was 16. He's an interesting philosopher to read when you're 16, because it's very much about, you know, don't listen to any authority, in a sense, make your own mind up, which is so important. But as a sort of anti-authoritarian led 16-year-old, I probably didn't need to read that at the time. But, but what's great about that is it's been like a central idea. So what that means is, as everything else I've learned, I've always brought it back to my own understanding of it. I've never been, you know, I'll get into stuff and I'll sort of binge on certain thinkers or certain writers and things like that at certain times, but I'm always integrating it back in. I'm not getting led into just following what they say because that's what they say it, which, I mean, Bruce Lee, again, we've got this on the wall in our gym, is absorb what's useful, discard what's not, add what's specifically your own. So that just as a concept has been in the background of my mind, I suppose, since quite a young age, and it's been probably quite influential.
It's funny, just as you were mentioning Bruce Lee, that was the quote that was ringing in my head. I was trying to remember exactly what it was, but you did it verbatim. So Bruce Lee's obviously been a big kind of influence. Are there any other experiences or people? I mean, you've obviously worked in a lot of environments, you've come across a lot of very good coaches and very good athletes. Are there any that stand out as being really influential in your coaching journey?
Yeah, I've actually got a slide I've been putting on presentations recently, which has got one of the slides is my influences from sport, I suppose, more that have influenced me more technically, maybe as an S&C coach. And one is about my influences in broader life. So I'm probably able to list it in quite a detailed way at the moment, because it's relatively fresh in my mind. So I'll start with sport, and then this, because the other one's probably a little bit broader. So I'll go sport. I think, like I say, taking up people like Bruce Lee, who I'd almost include in the other sort of slide, really. There was, I think, Simon Nainby, who was my first influence into what S&C was. So Simon Nainby was from the same area I'm from, grew up, went like sort of, was involved with the same rugby club. He used to come down and do sort of speed sessions. And then through that and through conversation and me saying, this is pretty cool, like, how can I get into this? Him sort of talking about S&C and give me some websites to follow, like Elite FTS, DeFranco's, Westside Barbell. And then me just going on those websites and almost like consuming everything I could. And Louis Simmons and Westside Barber had a reading list. So then I'd go and buy all those books and read all them. And I'd read a lot of them before I even started uni. And I didn't understand them, to be honest, but I just read them, which is a common thing I do with books. You know, you don't need to understand it straight away. It will catch up with you eventually. So in terms of those sort of thinkers, Buddy Morris, the same one, Elite FGS, James Smith, the thinker, like they used to write articles, and it was always about this holistic idea of sport. So I was very connected to this holistic idea of sport. And then all of the stuff they'd be recommending would be mostly Russian influenced, like Eastern influenced, and then Charlie Francis as well. So that was sort of my foundation coming into university. And then in university, you get more of your broad, I suppose, exposure to research and things like that. I was never sort of taken with research as an approach. It's something that I think I'll probably come back to with more interest in later in life. I feel like I wanted to go out and coach, and that's what I was always interested in. I was interested in coaching, so I wasn't taken too much of the process of following research, but I would, especially while I was in university, read an awful lot of that as well for that foundation. So people like Martin Boucher, David Girard, and like their conditioning papers and things like that, hugely influential on my conditioning philosophy. Stephen Saylor has done a lot of research on endurance athletes, again, hugely influential in terms of how I think about conditioning. And then it's not just conditioning, really, because all of that adds into my overall idea of how do you manage a program, how do you get the best out of athletes. Trying to think research, but that's just why we're on it, if there's any others that jump out. But you know, you come across some key papers, key review papers at certain times in your life, they're quite influential. There certainly was a few of them around around the time I was studying. Then it was people like Joel Jameson on conditioning, coming across his book when I was probably in my second year of uni, and just making sense of all, you know, you spent your first year, most of your second year just exposed to physiology and not in a very applied sense. And you've got these terms, you're not 100% what they sure what they mean or how they apply. And then Joel Jameson's book just gave me this way of connecting it together. And then since then, so when I left uni, my first internship was at WASP with Dan Howes. So Dan, again, really lucky in terms of how you fall, because Dan had come from the IS and had quite a broad background in sports himself. So he saw the world in that quite broad manner. So I picked up probably an awful lot from him in terms of managing a program, you know, that approach of utilizing sports science that would almost be quite synonymous with that data-led approach that would be more well understood, more associated with like an EIS or these big organizations. So I picked that up first through Dan, and then but he had quite a balanced approach with it, because he was taking that and applying it in team sport setting. And you have to be, it's much harder to be purist with an approach in a team full of 45 people. I was chatting to Dan about it the other day, and it's something actually reflecting on it. He was, I think he was 30, 31 when he took on that role. So I'm 32 now. But I remember him, that was his first, he'd worked in England rugby with women, and then he came into, so that was his first job in senior men's rugby, essentially. And him having to figure that out as he went a little bit as well. So, but Dan had a huge influence, and then he moved on from there to sevens. It became quite apparent to me as how they were going to try and play it, is that I was going to end up with a lot of his responsibility. But at the time, I was a junior by title, junior S&C. So I said, look, I want that. I'm happy with that, but I want a senior title and I want more money. And they said, yeah, they didn't give me as much money as the other senior coaches on, but they gave me more money. So, and that worked out. You know, so Dan moving on gave me that opportunity to basically, I was co-leading a program. I was a year and a bit out of university, and I was quite aware that that was faster than I expected to progress in terms of title. And I was conscious that I could have sort of rode that title for the rest of my career in a way and done pretty well, but I wasn't interested in just the title. I wanted to have some depth underneath it, and partly because of the politics of the team. So I was there for another year, employed with the first team, but then I left and took on a consultant role with the academy, which kept my foot in the sort of, well, gave me some consistent income, which was helpful. But then I also then started to explore like my own consulting, doing more of the contact skill stuff as well. And then obviously then picked up again with Dan at England Seven. So Dan's been a huge influence. Who else? And then Tappers, who's my business partner, who's at WASP with me as well. Like, you know, you pick up from people and their approach and so much in terms of Tappers' approach and how he was with players. And you just pick out things that I suppose that make sense to you in terms of what you connect with. Like they're, how you connect with people's approach. And I think Tappers is someone whose approach I'm massively connected with, which is why when the opportunity came to sort of go into business with him, it was a no-brainer. He was like the perfect person I had in mind if I was going to run a business with anyone. So that would be the key people I can think of from a sports perspective. From like the other perspective, again, I've been so interested in reading and learning from so many different areas. There's a lot of psychologists in there. I read a fair amount of Carl Jung, Carl Rogers. I'm very interested in the moment. I think Carl Rogers should be required reading for coaches. It's just this humanistic approach, essentially. You know, it's this ability to connect with people, help them along their journey to become their full self. He would talk about that sort of idea. Jordan Peterson, I spent a long time before he was sort of famous, I suppose. I've just come across him on the internet and binge watched all his lectures on psychology, human behavior. Robert Sapolsky, he's got human behavioral biology lectures on YouTube. Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers, his book's very influential. Reading them in university. Who else? A lot of comedians, and very influenced by comedians in a way, and their approach. Like what a comedian does is stands on the boundaries of the world and explains them in a way through comedy in a way. So that idea of, and mythologically, this is quite a Carl Jung influence, mythologically speaking, the Joker character is, that's the role it plays, you know, sits on the boundaries and makes fun of things, these ridiculous boundaries we put in place, and we think they're real, and then they show that they're not. So that, and then there's key people like Dave Chappelle, I think, you know, Tommy Tiernan are two that I'll watch them, but they're quite philosophical in terms of how they talk about, so I connect with that side of it as well. And then writers, and a lot of writers, Hermann Hesse, probably my favorite book I've shared a couple of times online, Siddhartha, written by Hermann Hesse, very much influenced by him. People like Jack Kerouac. Who else have I been reading lately? Henry Miller. Robert Persig's books. You know, there's a lot of books that I've written, and they've had a very powerful influence in terms of how I suppose view the world. So it becomes part of how I approach everything I do, including coaching, including having a business and everything else.
That's awesome. I love that, because if you said to someone who just came out of uni, you know, what books are you reading? It would be, you know, Essentials of Strength Conditioning or Super Training, all these kind of things. But the longer you're in the game, the more you realize that dealing with human beings is complex, and psychology is actually, you know, before I can get you on the program, I think you should be on, I need your buy-in. And that's a whole nother realm. And all those things you've mentioned there around psychology and interpersonal relationships and, you know, understanding human beings is a whole area we don't really talk about in coaching, but that's actually what we're doing every single day.
It doesn't matter what you know if you can't communicate or get it across. And actually, it's not really about what you know. It's about the other person's problem they're trying to solve. And then you using whatever you've got in your toolbox, whatever that is, psychologically, technically, physically, you know, to help them on their journey. That's essentially what we're doing.
So how has your philosophy evolved over your career? So you've mentioned a lot of influences, a lot of maybe slightly different schools of thought. So give us a bit of a whistle-stop tour of what's your philosophy these days, and how's that been changing?
I can quite clearly define it to a point, but I haven't really redefined this for myself in the last 5 or 6 years. So at one point I sat down, I just defined it through presentation for myself more than anything else on what my philosophy was. And essentially it can be summarized in, I came up with the term cultivate heroes, which was very influenced by Carl Jung, Jordan Peterson, and like mythological ideas of the hero story. But heroes are those who can face chaos and come up with a solution. And, you know, in the stories that might be come back with treasure, or the, you know, the traditional George and the Dragon stories about fighting a dragon and saving a princess. Like, it's with all these stories, it's not about the literal sense of them. It's something underneath that it represents. So I read a lot into that. And I thought at the time I came up with that, I was working simultaneously with Speedworks and Jonas Tadeu. Someone else I should have mentioned, actually, in terms of my sporting influence, just being spending a year with him, and not just him, but the other coaches that were there. It was such an amazing environment to be in. And I love that athletics environment, and it was the pace of life. I could learn a lot. So Jonas, I was there with Speedworks. I was at the English Institute of Sport with GB Kayaking, and I was with England Sevens and the RFU. And then I also had my own business, which was essentially mostly personal training, bits of consulting in terms of contact skills and stuff like that around it. That same year, my wife just started studying medicine. She was pregnant with our second child. We had no money. Like, even though I was working a lot, we had massive, huge debts and things like that. So we were in the midst of chaos, but at the same time I was like binge watching Jordan Peterson and then reading lots of Carl Jung, and then this
he's all about chaos and order, isn't he?
Chaos and order, yeah. So it gave me a narrative to make sense of what was happening to me in a way, and I could couldn't do much about it, but I could just understand in where I was relative to where I've been and where I was going, and that story was very powerful. So I essentially summarized my philosophy in terms of going, well, what is it that all of these sports, all these places I'm working with, what's the connecting idea? And it was this idea of heroes. I thought, well, my aim ultimately is to cultivate heroes, and these individuals that can face the chaos or the unknown and prevail. That's what great athletes do. And the greatest athletes we hold in the highest regard do that time and time and again in the most precious situations. And that's why they're held up in our society as heroes, essentially. And that's why they get paid big sponsorship money, because they reflect that. So that was the summarizing idea. So how do we develop heroes? Well, heroes are those who prevail within chaos, so they need some exposure to chaos. But from my own practical and experiential understanding, too much chaos can destroy you. So you want to be able to balance that with some order. And the yin yang, and we use the yin yang as sort of a modified yin yang, is one of the sort of symbols we put out a lot in the Rite. The Taoists would talk about the yin yang as a representation of order and chaos, with the white representing order and the black representing chaos. And they would talk about you're needing to keep balance between both sides. You need one foot in order, one foot in chaos. So that was something that I could see is in terms of what we're doing as coaches. Well, we can provide chaos or we can provide order to an athlete, both physically, technically, tactically, or psychologically. And we have to understand what tools we have to do that. So when we start to look at more coaching process, and you know, people jump to like the constraints-led model or more like direct cueing. You know, direct cueing is almost like providing order. It's giving them a guide out of the chaos. Constraints-led model is dropping chaos within on them. Okay, and then we can, you know, so at a broader level, rather than thinking, right, I need to do constraints based, or I need to do this, I think, well, where's the athlete? So how do you know if they're in chaos or in order? Well, are they comfortable or uncomfortable? Okay, and we need them to be in slightly more chaos than their order, otherwise they won't develop. But we also need to know and be able to recognize that when we've pushed it too far, and obviously too much physical chaos will end up in injury, too much psychological chaos will end up in some sort of breakdown. Too much psychological order is boredom. Too much physical order is means you're not stimulating enough to get a response. And then the same within technical and tactical, you can go either side of it. So it gave me this broad framework for then being able to walk into an environment and going, okay, I understand the principles here. I might not like, so for kayaking, for example, I didn't have a clue about kayaking as a sport when I got there. I had a month to figure it out, but I knew I could have a framework for understanding it that really helped me. So that's essentially broadly been my philosophy in some form or other. Like I might use different terms and it's developed in some ways, but that's been an idea, is that trying to understand that big picture before I then start even worrying about putting in the details of exercises. Like exercises are the very, very last thing I even think about, and I'm willing to change them all the time for any reason. If an athlete comes up and says something's changed in their schedule or something's not feeling quite right, then depending on what's coming up, you might just adjust the exercise and then address the problem in a different way. You know, so there's exercises are the last thing I'm interested in.
That's awesome. I love what you said there, because I think you just gave a really good overview of that philosophy of chaos and order. And it's something I've been contemplating recently, just thinking about the game of rugby. You know, defensively, your job's to create order when the attack's trying to create chaos in your system. You know, isn't it? It's trying to adjust to that and recreate order to prevent that attack. Whereas an attack, I'm trying to break down the order of an opposition's defense and create chaos in it to exploit them. But then what you've done there around the physical side of things, I think, yeah, it makes perfect sense. Just that whole thing of direct cueing and constraints makes perfect sense.
Yeah, it has to come back to those principles. Like I talk about that a lot with my speed and agility stuff. Attack is you're trying to create separation from a defender, and defense is you're trying to create... you're trying to stay connected with the attacker so they don't have space. You're trying to create space for yourself, or you're trying to take space away. And I think I saw a post actually this morning talking about first principles thinking. I've not heard of that term before, but it's apparently something that that Taleb, and I've read a lot of Nassim Taleb's another one. I've read all of his books and probably quite influenced by his idea of anti-fragility. Before I came to the order and chaos stuff, I was onto anti-fragility, and that was my sort of term for it, I suppose. First principles thinking, from what I picked up in the article I read this morning, is about that, just a bit like I'm talking about, going beyond, all right, we do this exercise or this method or that method. It's like, well, what are we ultimately trying to achieve? Why is that important? And that's probably the way I've approached my understanding of sport in a way, since I've basically been interested in it.
Mm. Now, it is funny because, like, as you say, you kind of, we're obviously standing on the shoulders of the people who've been before, and, you know, we think maybe there's slightly more rationale or slightly more reasoning to the way people have ordered, you know, organized sets and reps or whatever. But for example, you know, someone organizing 3 sets of 10 or 10 sets of 3 might have a completely different reason for doing it. But if we just accept it at face value, actually there might be 5 or 6 different ways we could organize that to get different outcomes. But if we just said, right, 3 sets of 10 is the prescription, that's what we're doing. As you say, well, hang on, we could, you know, change the exercise, we could change whatever we're doing. But if you come back to that first principle, well, what are we trying to achieve here? What's the actual outcome? Then that might lead me away from 3 sets of 10. I might do clusters of threes, or I might do, you know, something, do it completely different. But if we just take things at face value, then we end up being kind of pretty robotic and pretty similar to everyone else, don't we?
Yeah. And I was in a, this is exactly, you have to understand the underlying physiology and anatomy and then almost, and then the response you're expecting to get from the intervention you make. And then there's no thing where we just go, here's the intervention and step back. It's a prod and it's a way to see how it responds. And I think that's consistent across great practitioners in any field. That's not just S&C. Great physios or great osteopaths are the same thing. They'll change something in the system and then they'll see how the system responds. And what we're dealing with is such complex systems in terms of human beings operating in a more complex system of a competition. You know, we have to be able to, the idea that we could do something and absolutely know it's going to work is ridiculous. The idea that you have to squat, you have to this, you have to that is just ridiculous.
Yeah.
It has to be a, look, well, this is a based on my experience, based on what I understand about physiology, anatomy, whatever, maybe even psychology. This is what I think with my expertise at this moment. So I'm going to suggest this to you and we're going to do this in the program. But I'm completely open to then that coming back and going, ah, that didn't work, did it? Like, you know, and then, and you have to have that humility in how you approach it, because otherwise, otherwise you're running around doing stuff without any idea on what your effect really is. So like we exist as our little S&C role exists in a much bigger system of that athlete or that team's life. And if we don't understand the rest of their life in a way, or at least how what we do generally connects with all those different areas, we're much more likely to make things worse than we are to make things better. As human beings, we're more likely to make things worse than we are to make things better, because we approach everything through this very narrow viewpoint, which is our intellect. We think our intellect's the whole world, and it's not. It's just a small part of it. And that's where we can go wrong. So I'm always trying to check myself on that in terms of, am I getting carried away with these ideas?
No, I think that's true. When you watch great coaches, you know, they have the humility to kind of go, that didn't work, let's try something different. And there is that interplay. It's not, this is the prescription and you will respond like this. It is, I'm going to change this one thing and see, can you organize your system better? You know, does me making you hold a stick overhead, does that organize the lower body better? Or what if we change this one thing? And it's like they're kind of like constantly running these little experiments and not all of them work. And they go, leave that, it didn't work.
Yeah. And then conversely, it's about taking responsibility for that, because that can be used as a get out of jail card. Like, oh, I don't know. You know, and it's in, can end up almost being nihilistic, when actually it's taking responsibility for the idea that you don't absolutely know, but you're willing to put something forward and taking responsibility for that. If it goes right, if it goes wrong, where your part is in that. So it's this simultaneous, almost accepting we can't control the world, but accepting that we still have power to affect it in some way or other. And that power it's not necessary that it's positive or neutral. There's a lot of stuff spoken about in S&C is if it's only positive or neutral, not that actually, if I do this, it can also be negative. And every single decision you make, every single thing you do can have either a positive, neutral or negative effect. Everything for me is this risk and reward trade-off we're trying to make all the time.
It's funny, as you're speaking now, I was thinking it's really kind of reminiscent of the Dunning-Kruger effect. Like, I'm always very aware of coaches who have all the answers. You know, I want to steer clear of everyone, because if you've got all the answers, that tells me you actually don't know what you're talking about.
A statement I came up with years ago, and it was probably just bastardized from a few different places I heard it, was beware of those who offer answers. Anyone who's coming along telling you they've got the answer and this is it, like, they almost certainly don't, or they don't have the answer, and there's no the answer, and actually they're much more likely to hurt you and harm you in some way or other than help you.
So tell us about, I guess, your own little bit of chaos. How did the retail performance, what was the birth of that and the kind of catalyst of that, and what was your, I guess, your desire to start something for yourself?
I don't know, it was quite organic in a way. I think I've always been interested in business. Again, like, I'd read books about business while I was in university, like general business. I was interested in it. I'm very interested in lots of things. So it's not much I've done has been massively right, I'm going to do this now. It's been like, okay, this is quite interesting, let's play around with this. And then it's grown. I mean, the Arete, in terms of the concept as a thing, has been, that's 12 years, 10 years in the making. That's an idea, it's a concept, it's the logo, the curve, the stimulus adaptation, which it was originally inspired by, was something I drew in a notebook in probably second year of uni. I came across the word Arete in a book in the second year of uni, and it and connected with it. Funny enough, when I went back and read that Bruce Lee book a couple of years ago, it mentions the word Arete, but it didn't jump out at me then. It didn't mean anything to me then. But then when I went back and read it, I was like, how crazy is that? There's this little seed got planted at 13, 14. And then when I it's like that idea that the master will reveal himself when the student is ready, or the teacher will reveal himself when the student is ready. Like, that's that idea. I wasn't in the place to be able to make anything of that at 13 or 14, but at 22, 23, I was, especially having gone through almost like probably quite a traumatic experience of the idea of facing the realities of life quite abruptly. I think it was hard at the time, but dropping out of school and then dropping straight into an adult world in an office with all the shit and everything that bothers them, that someone's creeping up here. Oh, thank you very much. This is a tea delivery. So going from being in school, I was interested in was playing and messing around. I had no interest in going to university. I had no interest in revising or anything. I just was running around getting trouble, basically. I wanted to go into sixth form and do the same thing. I then wasn't able to. And when I realized I was going to have to do exams and the other stuff, I basically dropped out. But from that, I had to drop straight into a full-time job in the city, surrounded by people who hated their lives, who hated what they were doing. Like that, now I understand, was quite a traumatic, scary thing. But it forced me to have to face the realities of life if you don't take some responsibility for what you can do and what you want to do and all the rest of it. So that was a really useful experience for me. I've forgotten what the first question was because I've been put off by tea being delivered.
Oh, well, we were just kind of expanding in terms of, you know, how Arete performance came about.
So I'd always been doing all this sort of reading around business and things like that. I was interested in business. Even when I was at uni, I wasn't thinking I just want to go and work for teams. I was also thinking about my own ideas and what I could do. When I first got to WASP as an intern, 2 weeks, maybe a bit longer into being there, they had a meeting with the whole team, sat everyone down and said, no one's getting paid this month. And as an intern, I was getting £200 a month, which is quite good for an intern. I was like, but all my living came from personal training. It all came from outside of that. So I was like, yeah, whatever, you know, like it's, but I also was like, this isn't a sport. This isn't a thing you can rely on, you know. I think Stephen Jones was in the squad, you know, incredibly decorated, one of the best Welsh players, the best players ever, 100 of the caps for Wales. And he's getting told the same thing I'm getting told as an intern. I'm like, wow, you know, you can't rely on this. So I think that probably made me realise I would have to, again, be responsible for my own destiny in one way or another and not just rely on these teams to look out for me. But like I say, even it's more from need. Like I had to. I had I was personal training within, I think I started personal training seriously within a couple of months of starting at WASPs. And that was where all my income came from. And then when I got a paid role at WASPs, I was like, well, I'm still doing the same amount of work. I might as well carry on doing the same amount of personal training. You know, so for a long time, only until April of this year, have I basically been out the house at super early, sort of 5 o'clock, and then back in the house at 10 o'clock almost every day. So it's been a consistent, long, hard, and even to have the Arete has meant that. And the same with Sevens. When I got the Sevens role, I was still doing Arete. So I'd finish work with Sevens, intense, full-on job. And then in the evenings, it would all be working on Arete and the days I wasn't working. So, and that's sort of paid off now because when they pull it from underneath you, you know, I needed to build stuff up to build my income up from, because I never took loads from Arete, but I still had to build up more income, but I had at least a half a framework there in terms of a business and a brand and the stuff that I could do that with it. So it's been quite organic, to be honest. But it never really took off until Tapper's got involved, and there was two of us. We bounce ideas off each other, support each other, and it's so much more than just, like we always say, if there wasn't two of us, it would be much. It wouldn't be like half a retail of what it is. It'd be a quarter or an eighth or something like that, because just the way you bounce off each other, the way you balance each other out in terms of skill sets, it's very, very powerful, I think.
Mm. So a bit of anti-fragility there, and having something in the background that you're ready to plug and play when the mat get pulled out.
It's interesting you pick that up, because when I was reading anti-fragility in that first year I was at WASPs, so I was very conscious about structuring my life in an anti-fragile manner. I actually used to talk to Kate, my wife, about that, to say that, well, I've got WASPs, which by that point the second year was paying me. I had the personal training stuff that I was doing for myself. I was also getting I also worked for a personal training company. So I had this sort of split of income that was I knew that if one of them fell away, I could pick up one of the others within reason. So I always try to keep that in mind. It's harder as you progress, and it's you have to work double basically in order to create that situation. And I suppose no one in SNC shirks work in any way. Like it's not really possible to not work hard and be involved in SNC. So
very true. So tell us a bit about what does the retail look like day to day? Like what are is the scope of people you're working with? Is it, you know, general public? Is it just the Sevens boys? Is it right down to youth? Have you guys got your own facility? What does that look like?
Yeah, it's pretty broad. So there's four key areas we sort of break it down into that we work with. It's maybe more than that, but essentially elite athletes, which encompasses teams such as Richmond, rugby, and then one-to-one works. We work with a variety of athletes one-to-one in different times and different ways, sometimes face-to-face, sometimes mobile support, like programming. And then youth athletes, which would encompass basically camps and schools, and academy. We've got an academy based out of Richmond with 25 kids now. It's going really well. And then one-to-one sort of work as well. You've got the general public is something we're sort of moving more into with our everyday athlete program. So we've got two gyms now. We've got one based in Richmond, one based in High Wycombe. And then the other part of what we do is coach development. So that's sort of the performance lyceums, but also our own sort of stuff. We've done speed and agility seminars. I did a conditioning webinar in the summer. So that's all part of that as well. And then all the coaches that work with us, coach development's a massive part for us in terms of their experience. So we want them to feel like it's an incredibly valuable experience being with Arete. So hopefully, you know, we're able to have enough work that they stay with us and grow. But even if other opportunities come up and they end up in different teams, that's fine and that's great too, because you know, once we get a reputation for developing coaches, and it's the great place for that, we're always going to get a good young coaches coming to us to want to develop. And that balance between having the right people interested, but also us making sure we work hard to develop them, which again is a lot of work. You know, it's not work you're getting paid for directly in a way. It's something that you're going, right, this is what we think the company to operate needs, great people, and we want to help great people become even more great. That's sort of that's the underlying principle with everything we do. So that's what connects the elite to the youth, to the everyday athletes and the coaches we work with. It's all about helping someone progress on their personal journey in one way or another. So that's, I suppose, the connecting point.
Yeah, coming back to that cultivating heroes, I guess, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
I mean, you've had some, like you're obviously saying there about, you know, wanting people to feel like it's valuable to work for Arete and valuable to be involved. I don't think it takes much digging to see that in like the caliber of guests you've had with the Lyceums is like outrageously high. So for people who haven't come across the performance Lyceums that you've had before, give us a bit of who are some of the headliners that you've had over the last few months or years?
Yeah, we've been pretty lucky. So we had, so we started off with Dan Howes and Clive Brewer, which obviously Dan was a close connection. And then Clive was someone we'd interacted with before. But again, as a starting pair, it was pretty cool. And then from that, actually, my favourite one. And the second one we had, which was my favourite one in a way, because it was two individuals you won't find much about online at all. But one of them was Carlo Brizzichelli, who's rewritten some of Bomper's books on periodization. Amazing coach who I spent, 10 days out in Cuba with, and I trained with the Cuban athletics team, who he consulted for at the time, still does actually. And then with him was the head jumps coach of Cuba, Alexander Navaz. And you think, like, you're not getting an insight into the Cuban jumps program as we were able to. It's incredible. And it was in Spanish. So Alexander presented his presentation in Spanish, and then Carlo
I remember seeing those two names and thinking, that's not two names I've come across before, but that completely explains why.
Yeah. And there's a whole journey with this, like you realize, and we never started the Lyceums for profit really. It wasn't about making money. It was just something that we were interested and excited in. It's been amazing for us, and it's sort of way over delivered in terms of our expectations, in terms of our what we've been able to learn and things like that. But I remember being really frustrated at the time. I was like, why don't people get it? Part of it is that we could have been better at marketing it, definitely. But, you know, part of it is there's that fickleness of people come to see who they've heard of. And that's completely understandable in a way. And it's a lot of effort, especially in S&C's lives, to go out of their way to listen to stuff. So I've come to understand it, but I remember feeling at the time like, why isn't everyone here? Like, this is amazing. And I think we only had like 8 people there. And it was brilliant. So, you know, I wasn't too bothered because I got to listen to it in a way, and that was an amazing learning experience for me. The third one then is where I think people started to realize we were there, is because we had Dan Path. So from there, I think that's where obviously loads of people came to that one, and then all of a sudden people knew what we were doing and what we were doing. I can't remember the exact orders now from there, but we've had people like Buddy Morris from the NFL. We had Brian Mann, Keir's done one, so he's an old friend, Keir. We all worked at WASP together, but his one was one of my favourites as well. I've always loved his ability to just concisely, I suppose, put across ideas. And he did this presentation over his learnings, basically, almost like little aphorisms on his journey so far, and it was brilliant. Blimey, who else? We have Frank Dick recently. We've had James Haskell. I know I'm forgetting some really big ones here. We had a great one with Remy, Ben Rosenblatt, and Dan again on rehab. We had Gordon Bosworth, physio, one of the best physios in the country. And again, for us, it was trying to find people just who are absolutely amazing in their area and put an event on that was experiential, story-based. It was never... There's a lot of events on that are presenting research. There's nothing wrong with that. But we just recognize that all of them are about that. As coaches, we were interested in the coach's experience and something ourselves. We've gained so much from conversation, from coffee shop conversations. And even actually when we've been to conferences, those conversations you have in between presentations almost being as valuable as what you've been presented. So we tried to create, that was the whole point of the Lyceums, was to create a space where that happened. And even to the point where we played around with things like how the chairs were set out. So we used to set the chairs out at the start as you would do for an event, and everyone sat down and didn't speak to each other and waited for the event to start, We were like, we don't want that to happen. So we took the chairs away and we put little stands where people could then, they'd congregate around and it worked. You know, they ended up chatting to people they wouldn't chat to. So it was almost about that experiential learning from other people's stories. The best way we can learn is from our own experience. The second best way, I think, is from other people's stories of their experience. So what was great about providing that time for conversation in between is if there's a young coach there, and we always tried to make them as cheap as we possibly could so that young coaches would come. And again, I don't think we did as well as we could in terms of getting those student coaches in, which I really wanted them to have that framework and have that reference point of these great coaches when they're still learning, because again, I think they probably didn't know who the coaches were and they didn't value them. So we ended up with quite an experienced crowd most of the time, but you still get some maybe less experienced coaches who maybe wouldn't have felt comfortable asking a question at the end, but they'd certainly say to their mate who was there, who was maybe coaching at a similar level to them, and say, do you know what when he said about that, I've had that same experience and this is what happened for me and this is what I took away from it. That's super valuable learning. Because if we're all going off just the theory and stuff like that, that's what we wanted to hear, was where does the theory not apply and when does it absolutely apply and can we figure out that line, and providing that space where people can have that conversation was the whole point. I'm talking a bit about it, it's like it's finished, it's not coming back. It feels like at the moment, because we had a few planned for this year and obviously we didn't do it. I thought about doing it online, and look, to be completely frank, you can make much more money doing it online than you can doing it in person, because more people will sign up, it's cheaper to run, and all the rest of it. So, but that's not what it was ever about. And I don't want to corrupt it by just chasing money from it. If I can figure out a way to do it online where it can be, you can still get those connection options, then I'll probably maybe look to do that. But the whole point of it is about the connection, about the stories and about that sharing. So if I can't figure out a way to do it online like that, then I won't bother, because it was never about a profit thing for us. It was always about just something that excited us. And to be honest, we've got enough going on. It takes a fair amount of time to put on. So I don't want to do anything that's a chore. And that's sort of how I'm with everything I do. I never want to do anything that's a chore. Like, why? Why would I bother? You know, some things have to be a chore, but generally as much as I can, you know. That's what I'm
watching. So tell us a bit about the kind of youth programs that you're running at Arete. How does it work? Do you cover off the kind of physical elements, the mental elements, nutrition? What does that look like for you guys? Or do you have any kind of operating procedures that you use in terms of addressing those different areas?
not massively like process driven, because everywhere's different. Like, you know, schools are different, the individuals you work with are different. There's obviously, it all comes back to that same idea, is we're trying to help the individuals be better at solving problems, and they were helping the school solve some of their problems by helping their individuals be better at solving problems, and it all fits into that. So it's very much has to be quite I'm trying to think of a better word than bespoke, because it sounds really wanky, but like, it's not, you know, like, it's like, how do you like connect with where they, what they need? So with the school programs, every school is so different. Like, there's a certain framework and way we're sort of, we generally work, but we want to give the coaches that are there, you know, freedom to be their great coaches. We're selecting them for being great coaches. So we're not there to tell them exactly how to program. We're there to support them with the program and build it towards something that can become somewhat of a consistent framework for that school. But that will always evolve. But that what schools tend to get is coaches in and out, and then there's nothing left behind. So that's where I feel we can be really valuable. And we've got a long experience now of working in schools, and between me and Tappers and everyone else in the company, there's like maybe 100 years of experience that can be sort of shared amongst each other. So the coaches working in schools get to share their experience within each school with each other. They get to help each other out with resources. And one of the things we do with the coaches, we have like an internal coach development club, which is different things, again, similar to the Lyceum, bringing speakers in. And we've had some amazing speakers in that. We've had Dan Howes do one for us recently, Julia Heady, an amazing physio. You know, we're doing them as well, because like we said, the coaches development is the most important thing to us, really, because we know that's how we can create a great company, by having great people and helping those great people progress in their own way as well.
So that takes me, your mention there about resources takes me quite nicely onto the next question. So are there any particular resources? You obviously mentioned, you know, Krishnamurti and Siddhartha and those kind of classics. Is there anything that you would, you know, your real top of the bunch that you would point people towards if they're coaching young athletes? Is there anything that stands out to you as being important?
For young athletes? Probably, this would be one of my recommendations to most coaches now, would probably be Carl Rogers' On Becoming a Person, as a book to read. Like, I think so many athletes and so many young kids are experienced like this authoritarian approach. And then again, we've got to find this balance. We want to give them some structure, but we also want them to become confident enough in their own abilities that they're willing to express that and not willing to give up in anything they do. So I think understanding what human beings need is much more important than anything else I could recommend right now. Like, any methodological approach to training young athletes, like, there's lots of methodology that I would suggest is important versus other methodology, but ultimately there's too much, I think, of coaches at every level of sport projecting their ideas in a forceful manner. That we have to share our experience, we want to guide people based on our own experience, but there's not enough of just trying to understand their experience. I think we need to be a lot better at understanding the young athlete's experience and what they're going through and what they want and what they, and then how do we guide that. So I feel like something like Carl Rogers' On Becoming a Person as a book, as a way of this more humanistic approach, is would be more valuable than I think anything else I could recommend. And that's something, awesome. I think in terms of Arete, that's as a business, as a company, it's about that, really. That's something, like, me and Tappers has come up with a word he calls buddiness, which is, again, wanky, but it's sort of, gets the idea is, it's like, why would you do it in terms of you're trying to just make profits for the sake of profit? Like, it becomes a cage. You create a cage for yourself. You create the very thing you're trying to get away from. So I'm really conscious about that, as having a business is the responsibility, that you don't want to create this thing that was the thing you were trying to get away from the whole time. So, and that takes some, you know, deeper thought in terms of how you make each step of the way, because of course you need profit. Of course you need to grow the business in order to make it something that can be the special thing it is for all the other people who work within it and all the people you work with. But if that's all you're doing it for, you're the one who will end up suffering as much as everyone else will for your approach. So it's a hard thing. It's a harder way to approach things, I suppose, but it feels good at the moment, and hopefully it can carry on growing and keep that sense of this feels right, this feels positive, I suppose.
Fantastic. That's a really good summary, I think, there of what we've been saying in terms of coaching that's applicable to every sport, every performer, every age group. You know, I think we need more of that rather than arguing about, you know, which, you know, is 5x5 better than this or whatever. You know, we need more discussion around the person in front of you.
Yeah, I don't understand where people find the time, like, to... I mean, if we're going to argue, there's plenty we could argue about in the world that are much more important than that. But then even that, I'm not sure if the arguing helps.
Yeah, very true. So where can people find out more about you and about Arete?
So I suppose Instagram would be where most gives a good blend of what we do. Instagram, I think, is at Arete, Arete underscore perform. I think it's the same for Twitter. So across those two things, sort of the work we're doing, we'd put out, we're not great at it, it's something that actually, if anyone listening who's big on media or like social media and interested in helping us out as a, maybe like an intern thing to start, but potentially growing, I'll use this opportunity to say that we're looking for someone who can do that, because it's something we've been trying to create. Me and Tappers aren't that way inclined, really. And I know it's something we can do a lot better. You know, we're doing a lot of work all the time, and very rarely do we find the time to be like, look, here's what we're doing. And I don't think it needs to be much more than that. Also, the website is arete-performance.com. That gives a good overview of what we do, who we work with, and sort of experience. My Instagram, I think, is tom_arete_perform. Sometimes there's stuff about training on there. Sometimes I post books and random quotes. But I suppose you'll get a sense of what I'm doing through there as well.
Brilliant. Well, thanks so much for your time today, mate. I really enjoyed that conversation on chaos and order and in coaching. I think it's really applicable. So thanks for your time. I really appreciate it.
No problem at all. Thanks for having me.
If you enjoyed this episode, we'd really appreciate it if you could do two simple things for us. First, if you could share this episode with another coach, teacher, or parent. And secondly, if you could leave a podcast review on your chosen podcast platform. This helps us get this resource out to more people like you who will benefit from this information. I'm gonna tell you no matter.